This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. About 500,000 Coloradans are not getting the mental health care they need.
The consequences of untreated mental illness can be catastrophic.
We hear from one Colorado advocate about what's being done to address the issue.
We also look at how farmers had hoped to grow local hops to feed a thriving craft beer industry. But a few years later, that dream may have fizzled out.
Then we climb a mysterious mountain of dirt you might have seen off I-25 to learn more about how it got there.
Plus, the Nutcracker is a traditional holiday favorite, but to make sure everyone can enjoy the performance, one Colorado ballet company is doing it a little bit differently. We'll find out more about this sensory-friendly ballet, and our film critic Howie Mofshevitz reviews the new movie, Roma. But first, a first-of-its-kind cloud seeding program has started in the mountains of southern Wyoming and could soon be coming to Colorado. KUNC's Luke Runyon has more.
The practice of spraying silver iodide into winter storm clouds to get them to drop more snow isn't new. But the method is. Both states already seed clouds from land-based towers. A couple weeks ago, Wyoming started using small airplanes just north of the state border. Now, a northern Colorado water district wants to expand the practice. Their destination? The headwaters of the North Platte River, west of Fort Collins in Jackson County. Colorado officials say studies show cloud seeding works to boost snowpack, and that the small amount of silver introduced to the environment has little impact. If it goes forward, this would be the state's first ever aerial cloud seeding program. Luke Runyon, KUNC.
In recent years, hops have sprouted up on farms across the U.S. As KUNC and Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, there were high hopes that the hops would feed a booming craft beer market. But that promise has now gone a little flat.
Hops, they're those little green flowers about the size of a quarter that give beer a bitter or sometimes citrusy flavor.
Exactly. Any hop-forward beers like IPAs or the hazy, juicy IPAs that are all the rage now, they all use quite a few hops.
Scott Dorsch is with Odell Brewing Company, a large craft beer company in Fort Collins, Colorado. He rips open a giant silver vacuum-sealed package and scoops out a handful of dried green hops.
It's like fall leaves almost, is what it feels like.
It really is like fall leaves.
Here in the brewery storage room, Dorsch estimates there's about $25,000 worth of hops.
And of all these hops in this room, are any from Colorado? Any grown in Colorado?
Not currently, no.
Most of these were shipped from farms in the Yakima Valley in Washington, which produces about 40,000 acres, or 70% of the nation's hops. Back in 2010, Colorado growers wanted to get in on the hops market, and in just 6 years, the state reached 200 acres, grown mostly by small, first-time farmers.
You know, Coors, if it hadn't been for Coors, I don't think there would be 200 acres of hops grown in Colorado at all, because I think a lot of people would have given up a long time ago.
That's right, Coors, one of the world's largest brewers, which is based in Colorado. In 2010, a company owned by Coors called AC Golden wanted to jumpstart the local hop industry so that they could produce a line of beer made entirely from local ingredients. For 8 years, farmers say Coors paid them premium prices, at times triple the going market price of just $4.
At that point, they had a significant role in increasing our sales and basically keeping us afloat for the first few years.
Ron Jovich was one of about a dozen hop farmers contracted by Coors. That premium price allowed him to build up his operation. Starting out, the hop farm is incredibly expensive, costing between $10,000 to $20,000 an acre.
To get the trellis built and the equipment that you need to string them up and harvest them and plant them.
Then, in 2016, the craft beer market began slowing down.
So we're seeing regional craft brewers struggle in recent years.
Bart Watson is an economist with the Brewers Association.
There's, you know, a lot of competitiveness out there. It's hard to get on in shelf sets and get tap handles.
He says the craft beer market is still growing, just not exploding like it was between 2010 and 2015. He thinks this may be in part why the market for local specialty hops hasn't reached the scale that Coors and some other farmers had bet on.
Even if there's growth in the market, we may see the hop industry scale back in places like Colorado, simply because they were building for a future that was bigger than what we've actually seen.
Colorado's hop industry peaked in 2016. Similarly, small hop industries in Indiana, Illinois, Nebraska, and Iowa have seen little to no growth. Only Michigan and New York have remained competitive at a time when experts say the specialty hops market is saturated.
You know, the old adage, don't put all your eggs in one basket. It's the way it is.
Jovich still grows hops, but he doesn't worry about finding buyers. Instead, he uses his crop for beer at his own microbrewery. Other hop farmers have left the industry altogether. Mark Riley grew for Coors, but says this year the company lowered their price to about $5.50 a pound.
You know, when you tell people you've lost your price, they're like, oh, you know, that huge corporation, you know, screwing the little guy, right? And that's not how it was.
Riley says Coors was clear from the beginning that their high prices wouldn't last. For their part, the company says they overpaid farmers around $3 million over the course of 8 years. The idea was that growers would eventually find buyers elsewhere.
We were trying to sell to other brewers around the state. You know, we thought a lot more of them might be interested in, you know, a Colorado product.
Other farmers interviewed for this story are still growing and selling to Coors. But Riley says he decided it was time to rip up his hop plants.
The money we were making just seemed too little, actually, at that price.
He says he's moved on to something else that, again, many farmers are hoping will become the next big crop in Colorado and maybe across the United States, industrial hemp. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
The life expectancy of Americans continues to decline. This is driven in part by an increase in drug overdoses and suicides, according to new data from the CDC. This is especially troubling in Colorado, which ranks among the top 10 in suicide rates. So is there anything the state can do to address the needs of those struggling with mental health issues? KUNC's Stephanie Daniel sat down with Andrew Romanoff, president and CEO of Mental Health Colorado, to find out more.
As we head into the new year, what is the state of mental health in Colorado? What are some of the biggest issues that are still affecting residents?
Well, about 500,000 people in our state are not getting the mental health care they need. Many of them are ending up in emergency rooms, some in jails or prisons, or in cemeteries. The consequences of untreated mental illness can be catastrophic. Colorado ought to be leading the nation in this field. We're not. Until recently, in fact, we ranked 43rd overall in mental health care, 48th in youth mental health. Totally unacceptable, in my view, for a state as educated and affluent as ours. We ought to be number one.
So tell me more about your group and what do you do?
Mental Health Colorado was established in 1953. I was not. I was established somewhat later. The organization is an advocacy group. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and we're trying to change two things. One is public opinion. How do we help more people understand that mental illness is not a character flaw and it's not a figment of the imagination? It's a medical condition and it doesn't have to be a death sentence. It's treatable. But the other part of our work is around public policy, trying to make sure that care is available and affordable and accessible.
When the legislature starts up again in January, what are some of the policies that your organization is going to be advocating for?
One of the bills the legislature passed creates a zero suicide model that tries to get more training to both hospital personnel or other healthcare workers and law enforcement officers so that they can recognize some of the signs of a suicidal ideation. The trouble is, when the legislature passed that bill not long ago, it didn't provide funding. We're going back to the legislature next year to try to make sure that we can actually put some funding in place. We'd also like to see more mental health professionals in our schools because we know that kids are far more likely to get the care they need if it's available on site at school than if they have to go across town.
You mentioned some policy at the state level, but we're also seeing more communities that are addressing this issue locally. And 11 out of the 12 mental health related ballot measures passed in the midterm election. So what do you think about this? Are you encouraged by these efforts?
We are. I'll tell you, this effort started in some ways in Eagle County about a year ago. And the problem in Eagle County, and it's not unique to that county, but especially pronounced, was that folks there are living about 120 miles from the nearest psychiatric facility. So you can drive west to Grand Junction or east to Denver, but if you're experiencing a mental health crisis, you might be out of luck for a while. And the truth is 50,000 people live in Eagle County. The county has one of the higher suicide rates in the state. Our state, as you know, has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation. They proposed a tax, in their case, on the sale and production of recreational marijuana, a 5% tax that would generate about $1.2 million a year to dedicate to mental health and substance use services. After Eagle County passed its initiative, we heard from other counties, Denver, Larimer, Summit, San Miguel, half a dozen other communities and school districts that said, we want to do something. We don't want to wait for Washington or the state capitol in Denver to solve this problem. We want to keep the money closer to home where the problem is. And the voters in almost every case, as you pointed out, Stephanie, said yes.
Let's just look forward, you know, let's say a year from now. What do you hope has changed during that year?
I'll tell you a few things, because I'm pretty ambitious about our agenda here. And I've met too many families who have suffered and struggled. In my own family, I lost my closest relative to suicide because of a mental illness we didn't detect. I wish I could tell you that in a year's time, we could get the suicide rate down to zero. I don't know that we can get from here to there in 12 months. I can tell you, when you're losing nearly 1,200 people a year to suicide, as Colorado is, when suicide becomes the leading cause of death among adolescents, as it is in this state, we ought to be doing everything we possibly can to at least put a dent in that number. So I hope the legislature will fund the zero suicide model. I hope they will approve our request to increase funding for mental health professionals in schools. I hope that we will enforce some of the laws we've got.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Romanoff. He is the president and CEO of Mental Health Colorado. He was talking about the organization's priorities for 2019. Stephanie Daniel, KUNC. We have so much more to get to, but I wanted to take some time to recognize that it is indeed finally the holiday season.
I noticed that.
Whether you enjoy it or you loathe it, it's here. Erin, what is your favorite holiday movie?
Oh, man. Well, I am a huge fan. It's not really a movie, but The Year Without a Santa Claus, because, mm-hmm. I mean, Heat Miser.
Oh, yeah.
Mrs. Claus, too, like, gets things done when Santa's out sick, which to me is just one of the earliest female empowerment messages that I remember getting as a kid. And every year, of course, I watch the very non-traditional Christmas Vacation at least a couple of times.
Why do you really, really love those movies?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it, you know, with Christmas Vacation, it just reminds me you can put way too much pressure on yourself to have this perfect holiday gathering with family. And just don't do that, because it's not going to work out.
Because your turkey will explode.
Exactly. How about you, Carly? What's your favorite?
I really love the classics, like White Christmas and The Year Without a Santa Claus, and all those claymations are always a good thing to watch. But I'm one of those people who will literally watch the cheesiest of all the movies.
Oh, my God. So you're the Hallmark Channel's target audience.
I am, because all of them have the same storyline. It's a middle-aged woman who goes to a small town where she was raised, but she's been so focused on her career that she doesn't have a love life.
Oh, no.
And
yes,
she finds either a like ranch hand or her high school sweetheart, and he usually rides a horse, you know.
Naturally.
And then he has two kids, but his wife has passed on. So then they fall in love, and then she stays in the small town.
It's a very familiar, very comforting story or trope.
And, you know, it's just, I love the cheesiness of the holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my all-time favorite holiday movie has to be It's a Wonderful Life, mostly because my mom has this movie-sized poster that was right above the stairwell going downstairs in the house that I grew up in. And she absolutely loves that movie, and we would sit and we would watch it every year together.
Aww.
And someone who also shares the sentiment of It's a Wonderful Life with me is KUNC's Desmond O'Boyle. He has a little bit of a different thought on it, though.
My favorite holiday movie is It's a Wonderful Life, because I cry at the end every time George's friends start singing Auld Lang Syne. It gets me every time.
Hi, I'm Stacy with KUNC's sister station, The Colorado Sound. During the holidays, my favorite holiday movie? It's got to be Olive, the Other Reindeer. Where else do you get Drew Barrymore and Michael Stipe together? Have a wonderful holiday season from me and the Colorado Sound crew.
Hi, I'm Stacy Nick. I'm the arts and culture reporter for KUNC. My favorite holiday movie is not the typical classics. I'm definitely in the Die Hard camp. I know there's a lot of debate about whether Die Hard is in fact a Christmas movie. Let me just end that right now. It most definitely is. Come on. I mean, it screams Christmas. You have Christmas music. It happens at a Christmas party. It snows at the end. You can't get more Christmas than this.
I really like taking the time to ask everyone about their favorites about the holiday season. And right now, KUNC is looking to hear from our listeners about their New Year's Eve traditions. So if you have something special you do every year, make sure you share it with us by visiting kunc.org/curious.
In case you missed it, Colorado has a new mountain.
I don't know that we can call it that.
Legally, probably not. It's certainly not near Breckenridge or Vail, and there's definitely no skiing allowed. You can see it just off Interstate 25 near an exit heading to Loveland. And naturally, we had to send KUNC's Matt Bloom out to find out where it came from.
Shortly after flooding devastated sections of the Big Thompson Canyon in 2013, an army of trucks and cranes rolled in to begin rebuilding. This video was produced by the Colorado Department of Transportation. It shows how massive the undertaking was.
The US 34 project involves 18 miles of reconstruction, areas that were wiped out by the river or damaged by the river, areas of roadway.
To carve out space for the new road, crews had to blast out large sections of the canyon, creating a lot of rubble. At the same time, an expansion project along I-25 between Fort Collins and Johnstown was in its early planning stages. So the two project teams got together and decided to make the best of the situation in front of them.
So they essentially took all that rock and all that blast material, they put it in a machine that they essentially processed it into, made it finer material that we can use on our projects.
Samantha Overton Katz is an engineer on the I-25 team. Once the processing was done, dump trucks carried hundreds of thousands of tons of crushed canyon rock and dropped it into a big brown pile right here near Highway 402.
I actually don't know who named it, but it kind of makes sense. As it got bigger, it became definitely a mountain, and just being next to 402. So I think it just naturally got its name of Mount 402.
The now five-story high mountain in front of us is technically called aggregate. It's the stuff that goes underneath a paved road. CDOT is adding a third lane on both north and southbound sides of I-25, so it needs a lot of it on hand.
And the beauty of it being right next to I-25 is it makes it a lot easier to get it to other segments of I-25, because the project just isn't here at 402. It goes all the way up through Fort Collins. And so instead of taking it from the canyon, trying to get through town, then get on the interstate, then get to our site, it's just much easier to have it right next to I-25. You can load it and then be on your way.
As it turns out, sustainability is a big thing in all types of construction these days, and not a lot of people know it better than Brian Dunbar. He's sitting at a conference table covered in coloring books, bouncy balls, and fidget spinners. And for nearly 25 years, he's led the Institute for the Built Environment at Colorado State University.
Sustainable road construction is all about creating durability, using local materials, using renewable energy, lowering our carbon footprint.
He says recycling waste materials from natural disasters like the 2013 floods can save money, energy, and time. But not a lot of communities think about it.
Often people are in a hurry to clean something up, and so too much of it goes to the landfill. We really do need some people looking ahead to say, where can those materials be used and how can we reuse those materials.
CDOT says reusing material from the flood repairs shaves some money off the cost of the I-25 expansion, but it wouldn't confirm the exact amount.
Yeah, it's a little hazy, but you can see the general area of where the rock came from.
Back at Mount 402, Overton Katz and I have climbed up to its western face. From this view, we can see exactly where its story began, at the Big Thompson Canyon a couple miles away.
And just the fact that we can take a disaster like that and then kind of find like a silver lining and be able to use the material from that project onto this one to not only make lives better in that canyon, but to make lives better on I-25 as well. It's just a huge accomplishment.
And she stresses that Mount 402 is clearly not for hiking.
And you don't want to be that person that gets run over or anything. So definitely stay out of the area. There's a reason it's called a construction zone.
Work expanding I-25 is just getting started. Next spring, CDOT will have to completely close the 402 exit for 4 months to rebuild the interchange. As for the mountain, it'll slowly shrink. In its place, crews will build a new park and ride. Matt Bloom, KUNC.
Whether it's music or theater or dance, there are endless ways to celebrate the holiday season. But for those who have children with special needs, it's only in the last few years that they found a way to comfortably participate. KUNC arts reporter Stacey Nick explains.
For Colorado Conservatory of Dance artistic director Julia Wilkinson Manley, the Nutcracker Suite can be a bit exhausting. As she tapes up a dancer's knee before a final dress rehearsal, Manley admits it can wear on her.
I don't mind it like while we're in it, but it's like after January.
Manley is joking, but she says it's important that anyone who wants to experience the magic of the Nutcracker can.
Reaching our community has been important to this organization since we were founded in 1992.
And that community has grown. 5 years ago, Manley heard about a program by the Pittsburgh Ballet Theater. They were producing sensory-friendly shows specifically for special needs audiences.
And so this environment allows for those families to have a family holiday experience where they all get to be together and they get to be who they are as they're enjoying the ballet.
Here, the house lights stay up throughout the show, and extremely loud or sudden sounds or music are minimized or even eliminated. But it's more about what's happening in the audience that sets these shows apart.
I, too, as a child, experienced being shushed by other audience members, and I know that for our families who have a member with special needs, that shushing is embarrassing. It is disheartening. It is hurtful.
Instead, vocalizing is okay. So is using a tablet or electronic device. And getting up out of your seat and walking around is completely normal. To accommodate these needs, CCD limits the number of tickets it sells so audience members can move about safely. As for the action on the stage, it's pretty much the same as any other show, according to dancer Caroline Capoletti.
The main difference is that we really try to cater to the needs of our guests.
But for the performers, quieter music means having to listen harder for sound cues. And with the lights on, the audience is clearly visible, and at times, front and center, literally.
A lot of our guests come up to the stage and like hang on the edge and like wave, which is distracting, but it's really, really fun. And they're some of our most exciting performances because we actually do get to see our audience and see their reactions.
Dancer Sarah Zhang was admittedly a little nervous about the shows at first. She was only 13 when the company began doing them, and she hadn't had much interaction with those with special needs.
At first, I was a bit confused, but then I saw this little girl at the front, and she was hanging on to the stage, and she was so invested, so into our movement, and she herself was dancing, and that was so special to see the impact that we made on her.
And that's important for families who want to try new things they might not normally feel comfortable with. Natalia Mendiola is a community programs manager at the Autism Society of Boulder County. She's also the parent of a 12-year-old with autism spectrum disorder. This is the fifth year they're going to CCD's sensory-friendly show.
Last year, as I sat next to him, I looked at him and he sat quietly and smiling and was doing all the appropriate things that, you know, you would expect of a participant at a Nutcracker event. So I feel like now that I know, I can take my son to any performance of the Nutcracker.
And for director Julia Wilkinson Manley, the move to make the arts more inclusive has taken on a new importance in the last 2 years.
I have a 19-month-old baby who has special needs, and having worked on this project and worked with kids in this population for many years now, I am now seeing this from a different perspective where I understand the hardships of having a kid with special needs, how vulnerable you feel, and how much you just want everything to be normal, and how caught off guard you can be when you are a parent of a kid with special needs, and how special you still want their life to be.
This week, Manley's son will get to see his first Nutcracker performance, and the holiday tradition will continue. Stacey Nick, KUNC.
The new partly autobiographical film Roma from Mexican director Alfonso Cuarón has been winning awards from film festivals and film critics all over the world. For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, Roma is stylish and engaging, but he wonders if it's worth all the hype.
From minute one, Alfonso Cuarón's Roma looks confident and alert to itself. The brave opening shot holds on a tile floor. It watches as water splashes across the tiles, and then the water gets sudsy. By the time the image tilts upwards, you see that the place is a garage which looks out to a street, and a young woman named Cleo, Yalitza Aparicio, is washing the family dog's poop from the floor before the father comes home. Cuarón was his own cinematographer, and he shot the film in black and white. The title Roma is the name of the neighborhood in Mexico City where Cuarón grew up. But both the title and the color palette recall the work in black and white of the great Italian neorealist filmmaker of the 1940s and 50s, Roberto Rossellini, as well as the neorealist devotion to the lives that people actually lead. It's an ambitious project for Cuarón, and he gets some of it, but not all of it. What the movie does best is catch the textures of the home in the city. It's the beginning of the 1970s. A prosperous but not rich family live here. The father is a doctor. The mother was a biochemist, but now she has a flock of kids, and the household includes a grandmother and two young women servants. Roma gives time and space to the look of the house, the family at meals, the parents driving the kids to school. The maids Cleo and Adela do laundry, fuss with the kids, and clean up after everyone. The father's often away, but the mother's mostly kind to her servants, except when she wants something badly enough to snap and call them stupid. The movie introduces the father with a straight-on shot of his immense Ford Galaxy lining up to enter the narrow garage. It's a play on the notion of daddy's home. Cuarón stares at the car long enough to make the father's power look a little silly. And when the car scrapes along the walls, and then Dad steps in the dog poop, you realize that this man has less dignity than he hopes. All of these things have a touching rhythm to them. The black and white is stark, yet it also brings an urgent abstraction to the movie. But Roma's also oddly detached. During 2+ hours, there's an earthquake, a forest fire, a divorce, and the near drowning of two of the children. But none of this has staying power. It's a movie without repercussions. When the grandmother and the morosely pregnant Cleo shop for a crib, paramilitary thugs in the street below attack a student demonstration. This really happened. And they kill a lot of people. The terror throws Cleo into a tizzy, but no one else seems terribly upset. Even the comic moments feel as if the brakes are on. You get chuckles, but no full-out laughs. Like the Italian pictures Roma evokes, Cuarón looks to the unfair distinctions between social classes. The family looks European. Cleo and Adela are shorter and rounder and look more Indian. Roma shows neighborhoods and people we in the U.S. simply don't get to see. And the movie's always aware that servants are part of the families they serve, until they're not. Cleo puts the kids to bed with love and devotion. Then she heads up a steep, lonely outdoor metal stairway to where she gets to do the washing. Roma won the top prize at the Venice Film Festival in September. It's been praised to the skies. I have reservations. I mentioned to a friend in the film business that I don't think the movie has the richness or the depth of those Italian films Alfonso Cuarón so obviously loves. The friend indicated that I was comparing it to the very best. Yes, that's what I'm doing. That's the standard. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members. If you enjoy listening and you're not a member, you can make a gift in any amount anytime you like at KUNC.org. And it is tax deductible, too. Don't forget.
Our show this week was produced by me, Carly Huckles.
And me, Erin O'Toole. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Ashley Jeffcoat, who manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana.
We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, and other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.